Good morning, my name is Sarah.
My name is Daniel.
And today we're going to talk to you about our research, and our project is entitled Post-Cardiac Surgery Surgical Site Infections, Risk Factors and Best Practices for Prevention. So just a little bit of an outline, we're going to start by outlining the clinical issues, our methods, our findings. We've broken down our discussion into the different risk factors, clinical management variables, specific nursing care interventions, and documentation issues. We'll also go into future directions and acknowledgements at the end. So the clinical issue, well, first of all, there are a lot of people receiving cardiac surgery every year. The Jewish General Hospital itself performs 2 cardiac surgeries a day, and in Canada, the numbers are close to 18,000 cardiac surgeries that happen a year. And there's no doubt these prolong life, they have better functional outcomes afterwards, but there's always the risk for surgical site infection afterwards. So numerous studies have identified risk factors, there's been best practice guidelines that have been developed, yet the problem still exists. None of the studies have looked at specific nursing care interventions before, and a lot of these studies are from 10 years ago, so there's been specific advances in technology, and as well we're dealing with a more older population who have more comorbidities, which may explain, but we need to look at this problem in more detail to see what exactly is the reason why surgical site infections after cardiac surgery are still occurring. All right, and even when these, so the significance of these surgical site infections is that they have mortality risks, and the more severe infections, the mortality rates are up to 20%. There's morbidity, pain, and psychological distress, and of course in today's economic focused climate, there is an increased hospital stay associated. So when we talk about surgical site infections, you can classify them in terms of the tissue involved. So they can involve the superficial tissue, deep incisional, so this starts to include the muscle and the bone, and then there's organ space or SSI. And when you talk about cardiac surgery, this is in mediastinitis. And also in terms of the cardiac surgery sites themselves, they can be sternal, they can be from the donor site, so the saphenous or the radial graft sites, and laparoscopic if you had a valve repair.
So at our study site, we know it's a study site known for excellence in care, very modern hospital, excellent surgeons providing the operations, excellent nurses providing the care, but nonetheless, there are surgical site infections still occurring. So in order to identify why these rates persist, we set out to look at who the patients are who are developing these infections and what their care was like while they were in the hospital. So to guide this research, we asked 2 research questions. The first being, what are the characteristics of a single tertiary care center's population of patients who developed a surgical site infection following cardiac surgery between January 1st, 2009 and June 30th, 2012, in terms of demographics and clinical characteristics and perioperative care received? And the second question was, what clinical characteristics and best practices related to surgical site infection prevention are not appropriately documented during the patient's stay? So we performed a quantitative descriptive study, and to do this we used a retrospective chart review of this population. So in total we looked at 127 patients. These 127 patients represent all the patients that developed infections during the identified study period. So all the stats you see are all on the patients who developed infections. So we looked at their demographics and clinical characteristics, their preoperative, intraoperative, postoperative care, as well as their outcomes. And so in total, we collected over 150 data points on every patient, most of which we will not discuss today. We narrowed it down into some very significant areas, but all of which will be useful for future studies, which we'll speak about at the end. So this is just a quick breakdown of the infections. The numbers you see are the percent of patients who developed each type of infection. So you can see that the both saphenous and sternal infections occurred fairly frequently. Most of the saphenous infections were superficial, but if you look into the sternal infections, many of them were in the more serious deep or organ space variety. And these numbers won't add up to 100% because some patients developed infections at more than one site. So we've identified that these patients are developing infections. We really would like to know what is unique about them and does that give us some sort of indication as to why they're developing infections. So looking at the demographic and clinical risk factors, the first one that we identified as a major issue for this population was age. So looking into the literature, we know that age is an identified risk factor for developing a surgical site infection following cardiac surgery, and the critical age being 70. Patients over 70 years old have a much greater chance of developing mediastinitis, the most serious variety of surgical site infection. Patients with these, of advanced age are more unstable. They have more comorbidities. And so it's an area where a lot of vigilance is required. So what did we find in our population? Well, our mean age was over 70 years old. So we had a mean age of 70.5 years old. And in fact, 61.4% of our patients were over this critical age of 70. Looking into other populations in the literature, again, of only patients who developed infections, they had mean ages more of around 65. So clearly the study site is taking on a patient load that is older and more at risk. So regarding age, what are some things that we can do to help improve the situation? So one recommendation is vigilant monitoring and adherence to best practice guidelines. And this is something we're going to talk about a lot when we talk about the care these patients received while in hospital. The next major category was diabetes. So again, looking into the literature, what do we find in terms of risk factors? Patients with diabetes are at a greatly increased risk of developing surgical site infection due to a number of reasons: hyperglycemia, acidemia, microvascular compromise. And so what we found in our population was that 56.7% of these patients who developed infections had diabetes. And this is actually really huge, because other populations in the literature had proportions ranging from 8.3 to 24.3%. So again, clearly this hospital is taking on patients that maybe in the past wouldn't have been considered candidates for surgery and that are at a very high risk. So knowing that we have a population with this high rate of diabetes that's at risk for infection, we can make certain recommendations. So one is patient education and teaching about glucose management. We have a relatively high rate of patient readmission for infection. So patients may be, these patients are diagnosed with their infection upon readmission. So it's possible that these patients, when they're managing their blood glucose at home, are not doing so adequately and may be putting themselves at further risk. And another recommendation is vigilance towards intra and postoperative glucose control. And we're going to speak more about this in the care received as well. It's an area of a lot of research right now. And so the last major category in terms of demographic and clinical risk factors we identified in this population is obesity. So again, looking at the literature, we know that obese patients are at an increased risk of surgical site infection and other complications following surgery. This is due to potential for pharmacological miscalculations of their antibiotics, other medications. There's many associated comorbidities, and obese people, it's known that the surgical site can have a certain amount of strain on it due to the body of the patient. And so in this population, 44.9% of patients were obese, and 11.7% of them were severely obese. So in terms of this population, again, we can make certain recommendations. One is the use of a supportive bra to prevent the tension on the surgical site requiring eventual dehiscence. Another is nutritional education for patients who are maybe coming in to be operated on electively prior to their procedures. And again, vigilance towards antibiotic titration.
Okay. So we also looked at clinical management variables. And what I mean by this are the things that happen contextually that nurses aren't necessarily specific in, but they influence the care and the risk factors that they should be aware of when they're providing their care. So one of the things that we looked at was emergency surgery. So 16.5% of our patients had emergency surgery, which means there was less time to prepare the patient. Also, they may have been more hemodynamically unstable at the time. And this is associated with 2 times higher risk of developing infection. Our patients also had a longer length of procedure in terms of the procedure itself, the amount of time spent on cardiac bypass, and actually a quarter of our patients had to go under surgical re-exploration for hemodynamic instability, which just means there's more time for microbes to even be exposed to the wound, more time for tissue desiccation, and just more time for poor hemodynamic instability, as I said before. So a quarter of our patients had late antibiotic prophylaxis administration, and the reason this is here is because this is administered by the anesthesiologist and not the nurse itself. 60% of our patients had blood transfusion, and this increases risk for infection because it causes a refractory immune suppression. And then most of our patients, actually 28% of our diabetic patients, had high intraoperative blood glucose above the recommended best practice guidelines, whereas 4% of our non-diabetic patients. So all of these influence the nursing care environment, which we'll talk about in a second. Okay, so one of the nursing care specific interventions surrounding prevention of surgical site infections is skin disinfection. So the best practice guideline is to provide 2 chlorhexidine showers the night before and the morning of the surgery. In the morning, one should happen 4 hours within surgery after any hair removal has occurred. So we found that 15.8% of our patients only received 1 shower, and 11.8% did not receive a shower at all. However, we have to wonder if this is due to documentation errors or if this is actually what occurred in practice. And then we found that 66.2% of all infections were coagulase negative staphylococcus, which is a bacteria specifically related to a non-sterile skin surfaces. So our recommendation was, of course, to ensure best practices are being followed and documented, so to ensure that these showers are actually occurring. And once again, patients are going home and coming back, so we want to make sure that there's rigorous monitoring of signs and symptoms of surgical site infection prior to discharge, and then teaching patients proper hygiene and self-care habits at home. Post-operative rewarming is something that happens post-cardiac surgery. So during cardiac surgery, patients are put in a hypothermic state to prevent neurological function and prevent injury, sorry. So the best practice guideline following cardiac arrest is to have a rewarming rate of 0.2 to 0.5 degrees following cardiac arrest. So hypothermia causes immune suppression, as well as coagulopathies, which can increase the risk of bleeding and more likely that the patient will have to receive a blood transfusion. So you're balancing that difference between preventing neurological injury and promoting immune function. So 36% of the patients after cardiac surgery arrived in the ICU hypothermic. And of those, 71.7% of them were warmed too slowly. And the median rewarming rate overall of these patients who arrived hypothermic was 0.14 degrees Celsius per hour, which is below the best practice guideline. So our recommendation would be bundle physical care so that forced air warming blankets are removed less frequently. All right, so nurses are very much involved in post-operative glucose control. So post-operatively, the best practice guideline is to have blood glucose below 10 for the first 3 days after surgery and 7.8 after the post-op day 3. So for diabetic patients, we found that the average highest blood glucose level, so on average of all the patients, their highest blood glucose level was above best practice guidelines for every single post-operative day that we looked at. And then for non-diabetic patients, this was for post-op day 0, 4, and 5. So it suggests there's room for improvement in terms of blood glucose control. So our recommendation is more frequent blood glucose monitoring so that we can assess the trends in blood glucose levels and advocate for patient-tailored blood glucose control. We have to be aware, though, that tight glucose control is associated with hypoglycemic episodes inadvertently, so this is something that we have to balance. But the hospital right now is actually undergoing a trial of more frequent blood glucose monitoring, so we can take some hints from this to see if it will be an effective recommendation. So one of our limitations is the documentation itself. There is many areas that we wanted to look at, but we couldn't, just because we were limited by the documentation. So one of these was preoperative hair removal. We wanted to look at preoperative teaching, and pain. So preoperative hair removal, it's recommended that we should never remove hair preoperatively unless it impedes the surgical procedure itself. But however, over half of our patients had preoperative hair removal, but we didn't know where it was occurring, why it was occurring in women, was it occurring at the sternal site, was it occurring at the leg, and we also don't know have a clipping time, so we don't know if it occurred before or after the shower. We wanted to look at teaching because, first of all, we recommended a lot of teaching interventions, and it was associated with reduced stress, and psychological distress actually can impair wound healing. So 26.8% did not receive teaching, but we don't know the details of the session. We don't know the cognitive status of the patient, if there's any language barriers, or if a verification of understanding took place. And lastly, we wanted to look at pain, because pain is associated with stress. It can increase the amount of glucose circulating in the body, and once again, distress itself impairs wound healing. However, we were dealing with a population who was intubated and sedated, so we couldn't assess their pain level until halfway through when the CPAP was introduced, which is specific for patients who cannot vocalize. However, this does not give us the severity of the pain either. And also, one pain rating was also given for the entire day, so we don't know if there was incidental pain occurring or if there was pain levels that was increasing or decreasing with medication administration. So based on this, our recommendations for documentation were to have more thorough, systematic documentation, especially in the areas we talked about before, because this will provide a visual cue to remind nurses of the best practice guidelines, and it helps promote adherence. It increases accountability, and also allows for better quality data abstracted for chart reviews in future.
So we feel that already from this study, we've been able to identify several key characteristics of the patients who do develop infections, and make several recommendations regarding the plan in hospital for these patients with these risk factors and also for their care. However, there are one limitation was that we could not make a general statement about all patients receiving surgery at the site. So the next step would be, and will be, I think, a comparison group of patients who did not develop infections. So using this comparison group, we'll be able to confirm or reject certain risk factors we've identified, possibly identify new risk factors that didn't show up in this population, identify care practices significant for infection prevention or potentiation, possibly, and pinpoint unique challenges facing the cardiac surgery population at this institution. So it's a very exciting direction we can take in the future, and it's something that's currently being looked into. So that ends our presentation. We'd just like to thank our advisors, Diane Breau, Valerie Vandal, and Bobby Perret from the Jewish General Hospital, as well as Sean Clark from McGill, for all their help and support and guidance over the last year and a half.
So the question was, what are the care practices at the study site regarding preventing surgical site infections intraoperatively? Yeah. So we did look at a lot of these factors. However, a lot of them aren't nursing specific, so we didn't include them in the presentation. We looked at closure techniques. Dehiscence is a major issue, so we looked to see how many sternal wires were being used, whether there was the use of a special sternal talon technique, whether they were being closed with staples or sutures. And the best practice is actually to close with sutures, and 100% of our patients were closed with sutures. So we did look at those things. However, because it is a non-nursing specific intervention, we didn't include it.
So the question was to comment on the appearance of our population as being very particularly ill in comparison to other populations in the literature. So we've looked at a number of studies very similar to what we hope the case control will look like, where they do separate out patients who developed infections and patients who did not in terms of many characteristics and care practices. And what we found is that in many instances, the patients who developed infections at this site are much more at risk for infections than patients who developed infections at other sites. So that would actually seem to speak very well of the study site, in that the patients who do develop infections are the ones who appear to be very, very unwell. What we don't know is what the entire population looks like together. So is the entire population of patients receiving surgery very at risk, or is it really just the ones who are who are at risk who are developing these infections. And so that's what we hope to identify next. But certainly compared to other populations of patients who developed infections, these patients had were much older, much higher rate of diabetes, much more obese. So let's see.
No, we don't know. We didn't look at that, yeah. No, we didn't look at their preoperative care because we were mostly interested in the development of the surgical site infection at the time, and so and what we can control in terms of augmenting care. And sorry, the question was, we looked at 57, we had 57% of patients who had diabetes, and we wanted to look at to see, oh, sorry, the question was, were they controlled or uncontrolled diabetics at home? And we don't know the answer to that. Because we wanted to focus specifically on the nursing care practices in hospital, preoperatively and postoperatively, and what we could manage to augment.
One that you will take in consideration now,
for sure.
And one thing we do know is that all these patients, while in the hospital, did have some sort of plan in place to control their diabetes, whether that was effective for them in their daily lives or whether they have a solid plan otherwise, is that's something we didn't collect necessarily. So.
Another very short question is, I thought you mentioned your sample was 157 patients. What was the large number of people who received an impact surgery between 2009 and 2012? Is that correct? So you had 157 patients in your sample. How many people
receive
surgery in that period?
So it's about 1,200 patients who receive surgery over that. Yeah.
From that population, 157.
Yeah. Is that, did you make some comparison in the literature? Is that kind of a normal number? Compared to the literature,
yes.
We were on par, maybe a little bit higher in some cases, but overall, it's difficult to say because a lot of the literature focused on specific types of infection, whereas we looked at all the types of infection. Yeah. Mm-hmm.